I wanted to tell y'all a quick story, another story that basically picks on my brother. And the story is about a time when we were in college, and we used to eat at this dining hall called Bolton Hall at the University of Georgia. We sometimes affectionately called it Revoltin' Bolton because of the, even though I guess the food was pretty good, that was just sort of a college student thing. And we went to a Bible study every Tuesday night, and it was sponsored by a group called Worldwide Discipleship Association. And we would often on Tuesdays at dinner eat at a big kind of a community table because other guys would come and sit with us that didn't have folks to eat with, and we could then invite them to the Bible study. It was sort of a, you know, kind of a low-key thing, like, hey, what are you doing tonight? Why don't you come to the Bible study with us? And so one night we were sitting at this table, and a young man sits down, and this young man was profoundly deaf. And he was wearing, this was in the 1970s, before technology was as advanced as it is today, and he had large hearing aids in his ears. And my brother started engaging him in conversation, but it was still kind of difficult for him to hear, even with these hearing aids, because, you know, it's a big dining hall with cinder block walls and linoleum floors, and the sound just kind of, I mean, I'm of an age now where I have trouble sometimes hearing in rooms like that. So my brother's talking to him, invites him to the Bible study, and the young man is a little skeptical, a little apprehensive, and says, well, you know, what do y'all do at these Bible studies? And he said, well, we study the Bible, and it's designed for people who want to grow in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And the man, and this young man said, what? And my brother said, grow in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And the young man said, who? And have you ever been in a room where it's kind of noisy, but then all of a sudden it gets super quiet, just all of a sudden the sound just stops, right? And so my brother yells out, Jesus Christ! And everybody at all the tables all around looked at my brother and said, you know, and I could hear a young girl over at the next table, and she said, I don't think you should be talking to that boy that way. And so, you know, that story has sort of lingered with me over the years, because here was my brother trying to be a blessing to this young man, right? And yet, it sounded, if you just sort of came into the conversation late or didn't hear the whole thing, sounded like a curse, didn't it? So, and I, you know, sometimes I think about what we're doing here today. You know, I mean, I'm really not trying to tear down the church, not trying to be hypercritical of the church. I'm really hoping and praying that what I'm sharing with you and what you are learning, you can take back to your own church, and it can be a blessing rather than a curse. But I've got, as I mentioned over breakfast, and I mentioned in the book, A Lover's Quarrel, I've got a friend in the construction business, and he's in the business of building big buildings, right? Not just houses, but tall buildings. And he said, for one of the first things I ever learned in the construction business was, the higher you want to go, the deeper you got to dig, right? And that little metaphor from the construction business has sort of stuck with me. That's kind of what we're having to do here today. You know, but the goal is not, you know, to tear down. The goal is to build up. In fact, build even bigger, you know, and stronger. But we've got to dig down. And if we're unwilling to dig down, whatever it is that we build up is ultimately going to come crumbling down. So that's my prayer, my hope, my goal for today. So now let me scroll forward through all the stuff that we talked about yesterday. By the way, and we'll see. Is this, Dick, I think this might have been the presentation from yesterday. But I didn't change it much, so I can go with this. I just left out a few slides. There were three presentations on that. Somebody, but let's leave it. No, let's don't mess with it. Let's move on. I'll just, we didn't get as far last night as I had thought we might, which is good. That means we were talking and engaging, but had to leave out a few slides, and so we may end up leaving out a few today. Okay. All right, this morning what I'd like to do is to continue the conversation that we were having last night by taking a look at a few individuals. And I'm going to sort of fly through this part of the presentation because I want to get to the media piece of it as quickly as I can, and also leave some time again for questions, because for me the interaction, the back and forth, is a lot of fun and robust, and it's where often I can hear what it is that you guys have on your mind. But I did want to spend a few minutes this morning on some of key leaders in the especially the televangelist world that, whether we like it or not, are shaping the way we are thinking in the evangelical movement. I just did an article about the Trinity Broadcasting Network. In fact, I think it's in this latest issue of World Magazine. If any of y'all get World, you might have seen it. Let me see if I can find it here real quickly. It's called Sex, Lies, and Television, which is about the Trinity Broadcasting Network and some of the scandals that they have there. We were kind of surprised. This article that has ended up being the most popular article that we posted on our website this year. And it's gotten more hits in the last 2 weeks than any article in any two-week period this year. So it's pretty remarkable what is going on out there in the world. But unfortunately, what happens on television, you know that old saying, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas? You know, have you ever heard that expression? It's in their advertising. Well, unfortunately, what happens in California usually spreads to the rest of the country. And both politically, but also, in terms of television. Not only do you have Hollywood in California, but you've got the Trinity Broadcasting Network just down the street in Santa Ana, California. So I thought it would be interesting just to take a little bit of an extra look at some of the celebrity televangelists and others. And these are the ones guys we're going to look at just very briefly today. Jim Baker, you remember Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, the PTO scandal. John Bennett, most of you probably don't remember John Bennett, but that was one of the largest financial scandals in American history whenever it happened in the late 1990s. Todd Bentley, a faith healer, Joel Osteen, I mentioned Joel Osteen yesterday, and many of you know who he is. The Grassley Six, those are the six televangelists that were investigated by Senator Charles Grassley. And then we're going to talk about the roots of the problem, the seed, faith, theology, and television. And because all of these people and organizations have in common is they have a very robust television presence. You guys, we've got plenty of seats right here, or some seats here on the front row, and there's some scattered around. So come on in. Welcome. So we're going to take a quick look at some of these folks, because they are, even though you might say, well, I know these guys are frauds, right? But unfortunately, many people in the church don't know that they are frauds. And, probably many of your friends watch Joel Osteen on television. And to be able to talk about Joel Osteen and some of the problems with his theology and his practices, I think, might be helpful to us today. So we're going to take a quick tour through these guys. All of these guys, by the way, I've written about in a new book that I have that's not out yet. The book is written, but we're looking for a publisher for it right now. And it's called Faith-Based Fraud, which I'm really excited about. I think we've got a publisher, and we think it's going to come out next year, but it'll be a lot of fun, I think, whenever it does finally come out. All right, well, let's look first at Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Many of you remember the PTL scandal. How many of you remember the PTL scandal when it went down a few years ago? Yeah, this was, PTL operated from 1974 until 1987. It had at its peak more than 3,000 employees. In near Charlotte, it was in Fort Mill, South Carolina, which is just right over the South Carolina-North Carolina border from Charlotte. Charlotte sits right on the line. The evangelical community was largely silent. I mean, Charlotte is sometimes called the most churched city in America. There are more churches in Charlotte than any city in America with a population of over 1 million people. It's right in the buckle of the Bible Belt. Many of the employees of PTL were involved in these evangelical churches scattered around all over Charlotte. And yet they largely kept their mouths shut and were unwilling to speak up, even as they could see with their own eyes by going to work every day what was beginning to happen within these ministries. The company, PTL, the organization, ultimately got involved in both sexual and financial improprieties. And some of them are so gross that I won't even talk about it in a room like this, but other than to say that it was thoroughly corrupt, rotten to the core by the time it was through. And it took the Charlotte Observer, not secular media, to expose the PTL network. The secular media, or rather the religious media, Christian media, was essentially AWOL, as I say on the slide, absent without leave for the PTL scandal. And that, to me, is one of the lessons, one of the tragedies of the PTL scandal. Now, I will say in our defense, in World Magazine's defense, the scandal started happening in 1986 and 1987. World Magazine was founded in 1986 by Joel Bells. Joel tells me, in fact, I quote him in the book, Faith-Based Fraud, that he wished that he had had more resources in 1986 and 87 to investigate, because he was starting to get letters and phone calls from people soon after the founding of World Magazine, telling him that they should that we should investigate it, but he just didn't have the ability to do that. And by the time World did have the ability to do that, the scandal had already exploded into the public scene. But other than possibly World Magazine, no other Christian media were interested in exposing the PTL network, in large part because they were making money off the PTL network. And that, again, goes back to that idea of the Christian industrial complex that we talked about last night, is that when we get so entangled in the industry part of the Christian industrial complex that the Christian part often, unfortunately, falls by the wayside. And that, alas, is what happened with the PTL network. Many of you know what happened. The Charlotte Observer ultimately ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the PTL network. Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were the ministry collapsed. Jim Baker went to jail. Tammy Baker became an outspoken advocate for the homosexual rights movement in this country. And today, Jim Baker is in Branson, Missouri, basically doing what he was always doing. He's back on television. And he's living on a kind of a facility there that that is basically it's PTL Redux, PTL Chapter 2. So, but there's very little accountability with these megachurches, because most of them exist outside of any sort of a biblical model for accountability, a Matthew 18 model or a denomination or anything like that. Well, just a few of the extravagances, and I'll flow I'll go past this pretty quickly. $375,000 oceanfront condo. Now, you've got to understand, this was in the 1970s. You know the old saying by Everett Dirksen, the old senator, a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon we're talking about real money, right? Well, this was back when $375,000 was real money. Nearly $1 million for a jet, rental of a jet airplane for a two-week vacation in California, two Rolls Royces for PTL and his personal use. So, I mean, the list just goes on and on of the extravagances that ultimately came out whenever the PTL scandal went to court. I want to talk briefly about another scandal that most of you probably don't know about. This is a scandal of John Bennett and the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy. John Bennett operated for actually quite a long period of time, from 1989 until 1995, before he ultimately collapsed. Here's very quickly the way it worked. John Bennett claimed that he had an anonymous donor. And he didn't tell everybody, but he made people believe that it was Sir John Templeton, the legendary billionaire investor. And what John Bennett would say is that if you will give the foundation money, say, $1,000. Give us $1,000 and tell us what charity you want that money to go to. We will hold on to your money for 6 months. And at the end of that 6 month period, we will take your $1,000. We will match it with money from our anonymous donor, and we will give it to the charity that you want to give that money to. Now, for a lot of Christians, that sounded like a fantastic deal, right? I want to give $1,000 to my church, or $1,000 to my alma mater, or $1,000 to a seminary or a Christian organization, but why not give $2,000 for my $1,000? Why not give it to New Era? They'll match it. And New Era was able to say, plausibly, that we are holding your money for 6 months because we're drawing interest on that money for 6 months. And the interest on that money is what pays our expenses. Our anonymous donor matches your money. So 100% of your money, 100% of the anonymous donor's money goes to the ministry that you want to support. And we make a modest living, he would say, people, on the interest from folks that have let us hold their money for 6 months. Well, that sounds on the face of it like it might actually be a biblical model in some way, right? The anonymous donor remains anonymous, which is what the Bible says that we our giving should be, in many cases, anonymous. And the person that gives the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy the money gets to double the contribution that they were making. So it seemed like a good thing for all, except for the fact that it just was a complete fabrication. It was a complete falsehood. It was a complete lie. It ended up being a classic Ponzi scheme, which means that they just kept having to take more and more money in because John Bennett here in the top was not holding on to the money for 6 months. He was spending the money on all kinds of things. And he ultimately ended up going to jail for more than a decade. In fact, he just got out of jail about a year ago. So, I've tried several times to get an interview with him for my book. He's refused to grant an interview. Now, who's this guy down here? The reason I wanted to put his picture in there, this is a guy named Albert Meyer. And he was at a college called Spring Arbor College. Spring Arbor College heard about the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy and said, we want to participate in this. We've got people that want to give us money. Why don't we tell them to give the money instead to the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy, and we'll wait 6 months and we'll get double our money. Because a lot of the money was going into an endowment anyway that they weren't going to use immediately. They would go to their big donors and say, I know you were planning on giving us $100,000, but why don't you give $100,000 to the Foundation for New Era and we'll get $200,000 in 6 months. Sounded like a great deal. And in fact, whenever Albert Meyer heard about it, he thought it was a deal that was not only great, but too great to be true. Right? So he started doing some investigating. Now keep in mind, Albert Meyer was about 30 years old at the time. He was an accountant at the school, at the college, and he also taught accounting classes at the college. In fact, he wanted to be a professor, but he couldn't make enough money as a professor, so he was working in the accounting department to make extra money. Now, if any of you know anything about accounting, the job that he had was bank statement reconciliation. Okay? Now, if you know anything about accounting, or if you've ever balanced your own checkbook, you know that that is probably the most boring job that you could possibly do in an accounting office. So, but still, one of the things that it does allow you to do is to see every single dime that is spent or taken in by an organization. And he knew enough accounting to know that this just didn't work. So he ended up calling the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal, in explaining what he had found out about the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy, the Wall Street Journal said, we're not interested. And so another several months goes by, and he calls the Wall Street Journal again, a different reporter, and the new reporter is interested, writes a story. The Wall Street Journal writes 5 front page stories in 5 consecutive days about the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy, because by this time, the organization had taken in literally hundreds of millions of dollars and involved some of the top Christian ministries in America and many secular organizations as well. So this was a huge, huge story. It's the first time either up until that time or since that the Wall Street Journal has done a 5-part series on the front page on any topic. And what ended up happening is that the fraud was exposed by this one man who saw something that didn't look right and just asked a couple of extra questions and then had the courage to say the right thing. In fact, whenever he first found out about this fraud, he went to the president of the university, not to the president, but the chief financial officer of the organization, said, this is not right. I just don't see how this could possibly work. The math just doesn't work. You can't hold on to $100,000 for 6 months and make enough money in interest to support the foundation, right? So he's got to be skimming money off of the principal. But what happened was this: that 6 months later, whenever the Spring Arbor College, in fact, did get a check, this chief financial officer walked into Albert Myers' little cubbyhole office and literally held the check up in his face and shook the check and said, "See, they're legit after all." So, I mean, that's the kind of pressure that he was up against to try to do the right thing and say the right thing. But ultimately, the president of the college apologized to Albert Meyer. He subsequently moved to Dallas, Texas. The Dallas chapter of the American Institute for Certified Public Accountants named him their man of the year. And the Wall Street Journal ended up winning all kinds of prizes for its, not the Pulitzer Prize, but a number of prizes for its investigation of the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy. So this is a really interesting, but here's the point that the takeaway from this is that this was not a fringe group. These were solid evangelical Christian ministries. Compassion International, Covenant College, which is the college of the Presbyterian Church in America. And the list just goes on and on and on. Dozens and dozens of colleges and Christian ministries that you know got involved in this. And the reason they got involved was because somebody brought to them an offer. It was, I mean, the bottom line was, it was just greed. Anybody that knew anything about money should have been able to tell that this was an offer that was too good to be true. But greed got in the way. They chose to look the other way because of the promise of so much money. All right, I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about Todd Bentley. Todd Bentley is another interesting faith-based fraud. Todd Bentley was a guy that a few years ago, you might have heard about him. He was in Lakeland, Florida, near Orlando, and holding these revival services in a church. He was claiming to be healing people. And he would do, he had outrageous techniques. He would hit people. He would literally punch them. There's a video on YouTube of him actually kicking a woman who said she had, I think it was cancer, and stomach cancer. Todd Bentley's antics were very theatrical. He would basically, you know, yell at the devil or yell at the cancer or hit the cancer, you know, come out, cancer, kind of overly theatrical stuff. And he claimed all kinds of healings. Well, ultimately, the Lakeland Revival moved out of this church onto an abandoned runway at a local airport there. They set up this massive tent that thousands of people could go into in this huge tent. And they would finance the ministry or finance the revival by passing Big Bucket. Big, you know, like Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets, you know, where you can, you know, the Colonel's bucket, you know. Big buckets like that, and they'd pass them around. And sometimes they would pass the buckets around 2, 3, 4, 5 times during a service. And sometimes these services would last for several hours. But because they were at a remote location, they also set up one of those portable ATM machines right outside the tent, so that if you came to the revival service and you just happened to not have any cash on you, you could go to the ATM and get cash literally right there at the tent and then put it in the bucket. So, I mean, this was a... the ministry dissolved in scandal literally after about a year, and there was a restoration process that was initiated by Rick Joyner of Morningstar Ministries, which he's a guy that's really questionable in his own right, and I won't go off on Rick Joyner today. But the bottom line was, after just a couple of months, even though Todd Bentley ended up divorcing his wife and marrying one of his assistants in the ministry, all of this happened within about just a matter of literally a couple of months. Within 6 months of him, quote unquote, falling from ministry, the restoration process was complete, and he's back into the ministry today. So the reason I got interested in this was because for every time I hear about one of these faith healing revivals, because of the kind of work that I do for World Magazine, which is kind of looking for scandals, it's sort of my specialty, is doing investigative reporting. I emailed them and said, and called them and said, listen, you know, you're claiming healings. In fact, you're claiming dozens of healings every day. And this thing has been going on for a year, nearly. Surely there just must be thousands and thousands of people that would be only too excited to come forward and tell me the story of their healing, right? You'd think that that's fairly reasonable. So I said, let me have a few names. Well, months went by and they wouldn't give me any names. And that didn't surprise me because I'd been making the same request of Benny Hinn for years. In fact, I've got a little calendar, a little tickler system calendar where I've just got a little note card that just says Benny Hinn on it. And so about every 6 months or so, I just go ahead and call him again and ask again for a list of people. And I've never in years have not gotten any list. But amazingly, Todd Bentley and his ministry sent me a list. Sent me a list of 13 names with phone numbers that, at least some cases had phone numbers. Some of the phone numbers didn't work. I had to look them up. But usually a sentence or two about what they'd been healed of, right? So there'd be one person who had been healed of stage 4 cancer. One person that had back troubles their entire life. Different people with all kinds of different problems that had been healed at a Todd Bentley ministry. At a Todd Bentley event. So I called, or at least attempted to call, all 13 of them. And I was able to get through to 12 of the 13. It took me about a week or 10 days of sort of fairly constant calling to get through. But I ultimately talked to a real life person in 12 of the 13 cases. The 13th I just couldn't find. And when I say talk to a real life person, I didn't always talk to the person that was healed, because in 2 of the 12 cases, they were dead. And in fact, one day I remember this. I mean, I'm not proud of this moment, but sometimes this happens whenever you're doing the kind of journalism I do. I call a woman in Greensboro, North Carolina, and who had supposedly been healed of cancer by Todd Bentley. And a woman answers the phone, and I say, "Is this?" And right now, this happened 3 or 4 years ago. I can't remember her name. I said, "Is this so and so?" And she said, "No, who's calling?" And I say, "Well, I'm Warren Smith. I'm with World Magazine. And I understand that so-and-so, this woman, was healed at a Todd Bentley revival service." And there was a bit of silence on the line, and said, "Well, in fact, she wasn't healed, and I can't talk now because I'm on my way to her funeral." They were literally just moments away from having this woman's funeral. And whenever I had that conversation with her, it was hard for me to, you know, I mean, I was imposing. I mean, you realize that this is in some ways some of the bad parts about journalism, right? Where the cameraman shows up at the scene of the tragedy and pokes the microphone in people's faces. And I was aware that maybe I was doing a little bit of that and needed to be maybe a little more sensitive. But also too, it energized me for the importance of doing this kind of work as well. Because these guys are frauds. They're affecting people's lives in a negative way. I can't tell you of the many of the people that I saw, they had given thousands and thousands of dollars to this ministry. In some cases, they had chosen not to get medical help because they believed that it would be a sign of a lack of faith in the healing. But I can tell you that of the 12 I got to, 2 of them were dead. And of the other 10, I could not identify a single person that I think you would legitimately say a year after the fact had really been healed. Now, I believe in healing. In fact, I'm going to tell you a story about healing right before we go to a break. I believe in healing. I believe the sovereign God of the universe can do anything He wants to, and He doesn't ask Warren Smith for permission to do it. Okay? So I believe in healing. But I also believe that whenever you've got charlatans like this claiming God's healing for the sake of money, power, fame, sexual conquest, whatever it is, that is a tremendously evil thing that we as a church need to be concerned about and try to root out of the church. So, if you get a chance, read the article. You can go to worldmag.com, which is our website, and search on Todd Bentley. Actually wrote 2 or 3 articles about him, but it's a fascinating read. I can promise you that. Okay, let's look at just a couple more. Joel Osteen. A lot of you guys know Joel Osteen, and I'll move quickly through the rest of these. America's prosperity preacher. He's written a couple of books, at least, with Your Best Life Now, Every Day of Friday. I already talked about Your Best Life Now last night. The book Every Day of Friday, which is the new book that he's got out on the bestseller list, is particularly fascinating to me, because one of the things that I think is wrong with the church today is that we don't do a really good job of understanding the biblical notion of vocation, right? God, work is not an evil. Work is a good thing. God is a worker. If you read Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2, God looks at the creation and He says He surveyed His work. He talks about His work. Before the fall, God told Adam to work the land, right? Work is not an evil. Work is a gift from God. And yet we've sort of buy into a materialistic culture whenever we say that the purpose of work is to earn enough money so that you can retire early, or even we try to sanctify it a little bit, right? So that we can be involved in ministry, right? I want to earn enough money so I don't have to work anymore. I can devote 100% of my time to ministry. That is an unbiblical understanding of what work is all about. That's beyond the scope of what we're here to talk about today, except to say that whenever I see a book like Every Day a Friday, it just causes me to believe that he's bought into this materialistic mindset that says that, you know, that work is an evil, that work is something that should be avoided, that we shouldn't find joy in what it is that God has called us to do. He says he's taken no salary for years, but in fact, he's had millions of dollars in author royalties as a result of his books over the years. He's a pastor of Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, which is the largest church in America. And his style and theology have been highly influential on other evangelical leaders all around the country. A couple of things just about Joel Osteen, though, that I thought would be interesting. This is an exchange between Joel Osteen and Larry King on CNN. This is an actual transcript of that conversation. Larry King says, basically ask him about about Jesus. And I mean, is Jesus the way, the truth, and the life? And Larry King, who is not a Christian, I mean, isn't Larry King Jewish? Okay. I mean, this guy is not a Christian, but by the end of this conversation, you think Larry King knows more Christian theology than Joel Osteen does, right? Okay. Larry King, what if you're Jewish or Muslim? You don't accept Christ at all. You know, I'm very careful about saying who would and wouldn't go to heaven. I don't know. But if you believe that you have to believe in Christ, they're wrong, aren't they? Osteen, well, I don't know if I believe they're wrong. I just think that only God will judge a person's heart. I spent a lot of time in India with my father. I don't know all about their religion, but I know they love God. And I don't know. I've seen their sincerity, so I don't know. Okay? Well, let me tell you, I do know. He's right on one level. I don't know another person's heart. I can't say for sure whether you have accepted Christ for your salvation, whether you have repented of your sins and depended fully on Christ, on the grace of Christ for your salvation. I don't know whether you have done that. What I do know is that you better do that, that you have to do that. And if you don't do that, you are not going to heaven, right? I mean, that's just what Christian theology teaches. I mean, this is not graduate level Christian theology. This is theology 101, if you want to say it that way. Okay. So, Stephen Furtick is a guy y'all probably don't know, but he's a mega church pastor in Charlotte, North Carolina. He started a church just a few years ago. Now the church claims to have 6,000 people showing up on a Sunday morning. And by a few years ago, I mean literally about 5 years ago. And he has become one of the stars of the young evangelical movement. And he's become a great defender of Joel Osteen, as have many other young megachurch pastors all around the country. And this was what Stephen Furtick wrote in one of his blog postings not long after this Larry King episode that I mentioned to you. To all you mean-spirited name-callers who have made a career of condemning celebrity preachers, who the heck do you think you are to criticize a man who is impacting a city like Pastor Joel is impacting Houston? Osteen preaches to 40,000 people weekly. And again, this is this appeal to large numbers as a sign of God's blessing and God's success. If you wanted to use numerical measurements as a sign of God's blessing, then the most blessed church in the world is probably the Muslim church right now, isn't it? So you can't use numbers as an appeal or as a proof of God's blessing. You could get 40,000 people to come hear you preach if you gave away free Escalades at the door. This is Pastor Ferdy talking. Criticize by creating, not by running your stupid mouth. Regurgitating page 87 of Desiring God. You all know John Piper's book, Desiring God, by chance? Okay. And doing damage to the cause of Christ by casting aspersions on a fellow minister of the gospel. So this is a young evangelical pastor who looks up to Joel Osteen and is attempting, in fact, in Charlotte to create a church very much like Joel Osteen's church. By the way, Stephen Furtick is an ordained Southern Baptist pastor. this church has an affiliation with the Southern Baptist Church. This is not some, you know, freaky fringe movement here that we're talking about here. This is the largest Protestant denomination in America where this church is a part of. I'm not saying that all Southern Baptist churches are this way. I'm simply saying that this just explained sort of as an example of the influence that we see of pastors like Joel Osteen. Well, Joel Osteen, Todd Bentley, these guys are not alone. A couple of years ago, Senator Charles Grassley of the Senate Finance Committee did an investigation of six televangelists for possible tax evasion. And these six televangelists came to be known as the Grassley Six. I wrote a lot of articles. In fact, if you just type in Grassley or my name into a search engine, you will find a number of articles that I wrote for World on this topic. And Eddie Long from Atlanta, Creflo Dollar, where's Creflo? I can't remember where he is. He's also Atlanta. Benny Hinn is Southern California. Joyce Meyer is St. Louis. Kenneth Copeland, Texas. Paula White in Florida. And so these guys were all under investigation for fraud, for tax evasion. But ultimately what happened was the banking crisis occurred in 2008. And the Senate Finance Committee, of which Senator Grassley was the co-chairman, actually was the minority leader because Charles Schumer was the chairman, ended up getting distracted from this investigation. So ultimately nothing happened to any of these guys. In fact, I interviewed Senator Grassley in his office for this for the book that I'm working on, and I asked him, I said, Senator Grassley, did the banking crisis just give these guys a get-out-of-jail-free card? And, of course, he denied that, but he said that he did admit that they were distracted by the banking crisis, was not able to go back to these organizations. The Grassley Six, the Grassley Commission ultimately released a report. Only Joyce Meyer complied in any way, meaningful way with Grassley's request for information. In other words, not only did these six not change their ministry as a result of the investigation, they didn't even comply with a sitting senator's request for information. They just behaved with complete impunity. In fact, Kenneth Copeland aggressively fought Grassley and basically said, you know, if you're man enough, come and get me, is essentially what he said. And Eddie Long ultimately got embroiled in a sex scandal. Benny Hinn and Paula White both went through a divorce during the... and they were seen holding hands together. Do y'all remember when that happened? They ended up going on a vacation together and were like to Italy and ended up... got pictures of them in the tabloids holding hands. Senator Grassley vows it's not over yet. But unfortunately, it is over. The investigation is complete and these guys continue to operate with complete impunity. I will tell you that Senator Grassley also told me that he was disappointed in the evangelical church. That he said, you know, Warren, I thought that I would start investigating these guys and folks from the church would come forward, that I would get some support, that I would get information. And I got to tell you, the evangelical church mostly criticized the Grassley investigation for investigating these televangelists. Now listen, I'm a small government guy. You know, I'm the guy that believes that, you know, when people talk about government gridlock, I say that's a good thing. Because every day the government's gridlocked, that's one more day that our freedoms are safe, right? I'm not opposed to gridlock. And I'm not in favor of the heavy hand of the government coming in and investigating Christian ministries. I don't like that. But I got to tell you that these are really bad guys, y'all. And that the church is just doing nothing to police these bad guys. And so while I don't want the Grassley, you know, folks coming in or the government folks coming in, you know, I would say that if we don't want that, we need to do a better job of applying biblical principles to these ministries and try to start holding them accountable. So what do these six have in common? Well, one is they have a major presence on television. And that's really where we're sort of coming back sort of from 30,000 feet sort of back down to the topic that we're wanting to. So they have a major presence on television. Television inevitably leads to compromise. I mean, I wish it wasn't true that I could find a ministry that somehow hasn't in some way compromised their message by being on television, but in virtually every case it has. And the reason is because television is what is known in accounting terms as a high fixed cost business. In other words, if you're on television, you've got to feed the beast every single day. And so you start doing things like begging for money on television, for example, having charathons and other kinds of fundraising activities that ultimately end up taking over your ministry just so you can stay on television. And so what's evolved out of that is what they call seed faith or prosperity gospel theology. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But it's basically the idea that you give to God, not because everything belongs to God and we're commanded to give the first fruits back to God, but we give for the reason, for the purpose of getting a blessing in return. Right? That's what seed faith theology teaches. That's what's different about seed faith theology than the biblical idea of stewardship and giving. But also, too, for the most part, there's a complete lack of oversight and accountability with these organizations and a lack of financial transparency. Most of them don't in any way, shape, or form disclose their financial information. So I want to talk a little bit about the seed faith theology, just real briefly. It was popularized by Oral Roberts back in the 1940s and 50s. Financial prosperity is a sign of God's blessing, is the fundamental teaching. As opposed to what Jesus teaches, which is that it is more blessed to give than to receive. Prosperity televangelists say you must give in order to receive. Giving is not a blessing and not an obedience to Scripture. It is a means to an end, and that end is to get back, to receive, to be blessed. That's why you give, according to according to seed faith theology and prosperity theology. Like all false doctrines, it does contain a grain of truth, right? I mean, you know, we know that God does bless His children. And, you know, we know that there are passages in Scripture where God even at one point says, test me, bring the tithes into the storehouse, and I will rain blessings on you. And then God even says, test me in this, right? But we proof text. What we were talking about, Dick, you were talking about context last night. And I heard it's a little bit of a cheesy saying, but there's some truth to it, right? A text without a context is a pretext. Have you ever heard that expression before? And so what happens is these prosperity gospel preachers take text out of context and use it as a pretext to get you to do things that they want you to do. Do you see what I'm saying? So anyway, Patty Roberts, who was Richard Roberts' wife, Richard Roberts is Oral Roberts' son, and he's still on television today, ultimately got divorced from Richard Roberts because of his repeated infidelities, and wrote a book about her time in the Oral Roberts family and in the prosperity gospel movement. And she said, I had a very difficult time distinguishing between the selling of indulgences and the concept of seed faith inflated to the degree that we have inflated it. And just to take this idea one step further, my friend Phil Cook, who is used to work for Oral Roberts, has written a book called The Last TV Evangelist, writes this, which I thought was very powerful. TV evangelists are rich because of greed. But not their greed, it's our greed that is causing them to get rich. An earlier generation donated money to help those in need. My mother taught us about those less fortunate, and we gave because the Bible expressed great concern about the poor and the suffering. Seed faith transformed everything we knew about raising money. Phil Cook continues. Johann Tetzel, do you remember? Some of you that have studied the history of the Reformation might know this name. He railed against indulgences. He was the most aggressive of the Dominican friars selling indulgences right before the Reformation. Had a saying, as soon as a coin in the coffer rings, the rescued soul from purgatory springs. I mean, that was the marketing slogan for selling indulgences, right? Now, it doesn't sound too much different today from what the televangelists say. It doesn't sound that different, Phil Cook writes, from this. Plant a seed to meet your need. So history repeating itself in a way, isn't it? So again, their greed, it's not their greed that causes this, but it's our greed or the greed of those in the church that basically empower and fund these guys. So what I'm about to come to the end of my presentation, and this is going to segue into what I want to do after the break. I'm going to Is it all right, Dick, if I take a break here in the next 5 minutes or so? And then the evangelical future really has two competing, compelling visions that we're going to talk about more in the next hour. Orwell's vision of 1984, which I talked a little bit last night, was a vision of a totalitarian future, right? Despots, of a strong central government, of Big Brother being in control. And listen, there's still a chance that that could come to pass. I mean, don't get me wrong. We see evidence of that every day. But tyrants, totalitarianism, and legalism will destroy us. But Aldous Huxley wrote a book called Brave New World, in which he said that which we love will destroy us. Entertainment, amusement, materialism, antinomianism, which is basically a disregard for the law of God, and libertinism as opposed to liberty. I think most of us as Christians are in favor of liberty, right? Jesus said it is for freedom that we have been set free. But libertinism is an abuse of that biblical idea of liberty. So I would suggest to you that we've got two competing, warring visions that sort of at work in the world today. The question is, in some ways, you know, what's going to happen? Which of these two competing visions will come to pass? And again, these are just a list of books. If you take my email address, which I'll post on the screen during the break, I'll be glad to send you this presentation, and you can have that list of books as a part of that. Okay, I wanted to put Richard Roberts up here. And tell you one quick story before we went to the break. I told you earlier, I'm not opposed to healings. I believe in healing. And I wanted to tell you a quick story that I thought would be instructive. Richard Roberts is not a friend of mine, but an acquaintance of mine. Richard and Patty Roberts were close friends to many friends of mine whenever I was in college. And so I had an occasion to sort of hang out with, at least not Oral Roberts, but with Richard and Patty Roberts during my college years and soon after my college years. And so I kind of had a front row seat at some of the, you know, really tragic things that ultimately ended up happening in the family, including Richard Roberts' confessed repeated infidelities, his divorce, his remarriage to a younger woman. And I got to know Patty a little bit better than I knew Richard, and realized just how, you know, hurtful that whole situation was for her. So the bottom line was that I'm not a big fan of Richard Roberts as a result of all of that experience. But about 10 years ago, I was really sick. I had pneumonia. I had a terrible sinus infection. My ears were ringing. Couldn't hear very well. And because of that, I was taking a lot of antibiotics and antihistamines. And the antihistamines would cause me to be really sleepy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and wide awake at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so one night about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was flipping around the channels on television. And guess who I should see on television? Richard Roberts. And Richard Roberts looks at the television screen and says, "There, right now, there is someone out there with terrible ringing in his ears." Okay, that's me. Could be me, anyway. And he's tried everything, and nothing has worked. Well, I haven't tried everything, but, you know, done a few things, been taking antibiotics for a couple of days. And but Richard Roberts held his hand up and said, "I command the ringing in the ears to stop right now." And friends, I'm here to tell you that the ringing in my ears stopped that very instant. Now, if you've ever had a sinus infection, and if you've ever been on antibiotics, sometimes you know that it feels sometimes almost instantaneous the way these things work, right? You're all stopped up, and then all of a sudden, they just drain, right? So, now, am I going to sit here and tell you that Richard Roberts, or God through Richard Roberts, healed me that night? I will let you draw your own conclusions from that. I will tell you, though, that God did heal me of something spiritually. He healed me of an arrogance about the way God works in the world. And that while I don't necessarily believe I was physically healed that night, one of the things that I began to realize as I did research for this book, Faith-Based Fraud, and this experience that I had that night with Richard Roberts, made me realize this. And the way I describe it is this way. These guys are not our enemy. They are in bondage to the enemy. And I think that as Christians who seek to develop a biblical worldview in our lives, we do have a responsibility to stand against the evil that many of these guys represent, but we've also got to, I think, first look into our own hearts. And we've got to realize that we're all sinners and that God works in ways that we don't understand and that we need to have a certain humility about this. Now, all that said, I'm still going to continue to write my book, Faith-Based Fraud, and I'm still going to continue to stand against these guys. But I think it's important as a church that we create an environment within the Christian church where accountability and restoration can take place. And I think that, unfortunately, we don't too often enough do that. So I'm going to stop with, I think I've got one. Let me just hit my next slide here, see what it says here. Okay, yeah, let's take a break. And wanted to remind you about my email address. If you write it down, I'll be glad to send you these slides. And also, just real quickly, the Get World Now offer. If you're not subscribing to World, go to getworldnow.com and type in the word video. I designed that video promo code just for y'all, by the way, video. Yeah. And you can get the next six issues of the magazine for free. So, Dick, thank you. Now we get into a section that I've been sort of saying, you know, like last night I kept saying, we're going to talk more about that tomorrow, right? And then in the last hour, I said, we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. Well, now's the time where we're going to spend a little bit of concentrated time specifically on the media and its impact and how it shapes our worldview. And I specifically call this presentation, as you might have seen in the last slide, How Media Shape Our Worldview. And there are a couple of ways that it shapes our worldview, at least a couple of ways, and we'll talk about those today. I'm going to spend some time talking specifically about journalism, because that's what I know the most about. I mean, World Magazine is, you know, sort of, you know, what I do and what we do. So that's, you know, I've got a little bit more expertise in there than other areas. But I'm going to also want to talk about not only how the content shape our worldview, but also how the medium itself. And this is something that we've been sort of chipping around the edges of since last night. How the medium itself shapes our worldview and what, if anything, that we can do about it. I think the first thing I'll mention is just simply a couple of statistics. So these are statistics very much like the statistics you saw in the excerpts from the movie Captivated that Dick was showed before we started this morning. I showed a little bit of last night. The average young person will spend 54,000 hours with mass media by the time they've reached their 17th birthday. Now, by contrast, I mean, I'm hoping many of you are spending more than an hour a week in church, but just to give you an idea of the contrast, if you are spending an hour a week in church every single week for, you know, 17 plus years, you're spending 832 hours in church. Compare that to 54,000 hours. That's a huge, huge difference. You heard the guy say that the average young person today spends over 50 hours a week with mass media, and that's just about the proportions here, right? 54,000 versus 832, if that's 1 hour a week. So it's just a remarkable amount of time. I mean, for you know, no matter what you think about that, I mean, it's like if I'm a fish, I mean, you tell me I spent 54,000 hours in water, I'm going to say, great, it should be 55,000 hours, right? So, in other words, let's set aside for a moment whether it is a good thing or a bad thing, whether it should be. I mean, it is. You can't doubt that it's a huge thing, right? I mean, it's absolutely a huge thing. So what is the effect? Well, Senator Joseph Lieberman said this. Now, Senator Lieberman is no conservative. He's sometimes called a moderate Democrat, but he is certainly not a Christian and not a conservative. And he, I mean, not picking on him, but he would admit it. Gladly admit that he's not a Christian and not a conservative. More than three decades of research has firmly established that electronic media have a powerful influence on the attitudes, values, and behavior of America's children. This influence has only grown larger as the amount of time young people spend consuming media has grown greater. So we spend a lot of time, we're spending more time, and Senator Lieberman at least believes that the more time we spend, the more impact it has. So my question is, and the two questions that I want to spend the most time on for the next 40 minutes or so, is what is that effect? How do we name that animal, so to speak? And so we're going to talk about both the content of the medium, the liberal bias in the media, but we're also going to talk about the nature of the medium itself and the effect that that might have on us just by consuming so much electronic media. So first, though, let's take a look at content. And a lot of the information that I have that I'm going to share with you comes from a book called Prodigal Press, The Anti-Christian Bias of the American Media, which is written by Dr. Marvin Alasky, who's the editor-in-chief of World Magazine. First of all, let's take a quick look at a quick study that was done in 1986, which, of course, that's a long time ago now, 25 years ago. 1986, a book called The Media Elite, written by a husband and wife team of Robert and Linda Lecter and their collaborator Stanley Rothman. They surveyed media and found that journalists were well to the left of the public. Now, is that a surprise to anybody today? Okay. In 1986, though, that was a little bit of new news. And it because a lot of, you know, Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and even, I guess, I don't know when he retired, but it's probably into about the 80 or so. So, you know, you never knew, at least many people never knew, whether Walter Cronkite was left, right, or center. And so there, in 1986, whenever Robert and Linda Lecter and Stanley Rothman published this information, it was kind of groundbreaking information. And not only were they to the left of the public on issues that you might imagine, like abortion, pornography, homosexuality, those kinds of things, but also on things like affirmative action, on the role of government, on energy policy. In fact, they focused mostly in their study on nuclear energy. Now, some of you are old enough to remember that back in the 1970s and 80s, there was in this country a nuclear freeze movement, right? No nukes movement. And that basically said that we should build no more nuclear power plants, among other things. There were weapons as well. But now the environmental movement has embraced nuclear power plants. At least some aspects of the movement has embraced nuclear power because it's better than fossil fuels like coal and petroleum, according to them. So my point is that these things shift all around. What is left and what is right, what is liberal and what is conservative on many of these issues shift around. But what Robert and Linda Lecter and Stanley Rothman found was that wherever an issue is, you usually find most of Americans center-right in this country and most journalists left or far-left in this country. In fact, there's an interesting, funny story about Pauline Kael, who was famously the film critic for the New Yorker magazine. She wrote a lot of other things as well. And whenever Richard Nixon in 1972 won the presidency with the largest electoral landslide at that time in American history, he won 49 of the 50 states. Pauline Kael famously said, whenever she heard the news, "Richard Nixon, I don't know a single person who voted for Richard Nixon." Now, the sad reality of that is that it was probably true. Even though Richard Nixon got more electoral votes than any other president in American history, Pauline Kael, who lived on the Upper East Side of New York, probably didn't know a single person who voted for him. So it just, again, I'm not making a judgment for now. I'll let you make that judgment for yourself. I just report, you decide, whether this is good or bad, right or wrong. I'm simply saying that it is a thing. It is a real fact that most of America is center-right, most journalists are left or far-left in this country.